All right. Hi, everyone. I am so excited to welcome Eric Barker. So Eric is the best-selling author of the Wall Street Journal bestseller called Barking Up the Wrong Tree. And this is an amazing book. I'm halfway through this book right now. I've been on Eric's newsletter for a long time and I love it because what he does is he takes all of the like personal development advice and information that you've been hearing a million times. And then he actually questions it to break it down, whether it's true or not. And then he simplifies the truth. And then he tells you a funny story so you actually remember it. It's amazingly helpful. I highly recommend his newsletter and his book. And right now we are celebrating. He's got a second book coming out called Plays Well With Others. And it comes out tomorrow, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here and congratulations on the new book.
Thanks so much.
All right. So first thing I want to ask, so the subtitle of your first book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, is The Surprising Science Behind Why Everything You Know About Success is Mostly Wrong, which is an amazing subtitle, by the way. And in that case, you cast this really wide net about success. You talk about happiness. You talk about grit. You talk about, you know, life work balance. So why did you decide to really hone in on relationships for your second book?
Because I was so bad at them. it's not a do what I do book. It's a, I didn't know what I was talking about. So I'd look at the research and we'll both learn something together book. And, basically my first book, I took the maxims around success that we all grew up with, like nice guys finish last. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And I looked at the science and did Mythbusters. Are they true or not? And now I decided to do the same thing with relationships. And the crazy thing was, I had already decided to do this, but the deal closed for my new book literally 2 weeks before California, where I live, locked down. Mm. So all of a sudden I realized, oh, this book is going to be really important. Like, it just took on a new level of importance where I was like, I'm going to need this and everybody else is going to need this. And so basically I go down the rabbit hole with the research and test the maxims that we all grew up with about relationships. So does love conquer all? Is a friend in need a friend indeed? Can you judge a book by its cover? Is no man an island? And to try and figure out basically how can we be better at all our relationships, from friendships to love to community.
I love that. I want to ask you some more questions about specifically what was the most surprising thing you found out. But just first of all, to give some context for my audience. So as you know, my audience is really interested in improving their fitness and their habits. And can you talk a little bit how our relationships can really influence our success in those kind of areas of our lives?
Tremendously. It was shocking to me. Robin Dunbar is a professor at Oxford, and he looked at all the research on health. And basically, he came back from it and he said, do you know what will predict whether you're alive 1 year after a heart attack? He said, basically, one, whether you smoke, and number two, how good are your friendships? Yes, nutrition, exercise, everything else matter, but those two were so heads and tails above everything else. It was crazy. The Grant study at Harvard has been a longitudinal study that's been going on for over 80 years. And they looked at all these factors that went into these men's lives who they were studying. So you got the whole life from when they were 18 to now some of the men are in their 80s. And when they asked George Valiant, who led the study for most of the time it was around, he had to get replaced because the study was so long. They said, what did you learn? And of course, he learned lots of things, but he summed it up in one sentence. And he said, the only thing that really matters in your life are your relationships to other people. It's so, so critical. And we've heard a lot about how spouses are really helpful, really powerful. But the funny thing is, it's our friends that really make the difference. They did a study of women recovering from breast cancer. Spouses, zero effect. Friendships, huge effect. Men recovering after a heart attack. Spouses, zero effect. Friendships, huge effect. It was crazy.
I'm shocked. I'm really shocked.
Talking about one of the most surprising things, you mentioned surprising things. Our friendships make us happier than any other relationship. Sorry, spouses. Our friendships make us happier than any other. This is research by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman. Friendships are critical, and they don't usually get the respect the other relationships do.
Well, it's so true. One of the things I wanted to ask you is that I feel like relationships are in that, you know, that they do, the quadrants of things that are like important, but not, and it's one of those things that's important, but not urgent. I think even more so than health and fitness, which sometimes falls in that category too. But I think especially our friendships, like if we're going to toss an F at our relationships, we give it to our kids and our partners, but friends were like, I don't know. I'll see you when I see you. Like I'm so busy. So I'm really surprised to hear.
Age 30, in the 30s is usually when people get married, they gather all their friends together and then promptly never see them again. And like, it's really critical. But the thing is because friendships are totally volitional. There's no obligation. They're only your friends because you want them to be, you know, you have to like your friends. You don't have to like your boss. Sometimes you don't like your spouse. Some people don't like their kids, but if you stop liking your friends, they're not your friends anymore. So that means that's 100%, you know, your choice, not an obligation. And that's why friends bring us so much happiness.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing I want to ask you. So in my programs, I've got communities and Facebook groups, and I'm always telling people, come on, join the Facebook group and engage in the Facebook group. And not surprisingly, I often get the response of like, no, like Facebook's not my thing. Just give me the meal plan and I'll go over here and do my thing. I'm not a joiner. Like, oh, that's kind of lame. I'm not going to post my selfie, blah, blah, blah. But what I have noticed is that people who do that, they don't tend to have as much success as the people who are posting and really engaging. And it's led me to question, I'm like, okay, this is a chicken before the egg thing. Is it because successful people are like, look at me, I'm successful and I want to post and engage about it? Mm-hmm. Or is it the opposite? So I wonder, did any of your research talk about that sort of thing?
Oh, one of the things I looked at was the issue of be yourself. You know, should we be ourselves? We always get that advice. And the truth is, we are so influenced by context. The biggest influence on context is the people around us. And this is huge. It makes such a big difference that, you know, Christakis and Fowler, two researchers, they looked at the Framingham Heart Study and a lot of other studies and basically found that obesity, smoking, happiness, marriage, kids, they're all contagious. They're all contagious. Basically, if your friends have kids, you are likely to have a child, much more likely to have a child the next 2 years. Get married, you're more likely to get married. If someone you consider a friend becomes obese, you have a 50% greater chance of becoming obese. And if the feeling is mutual, you know, you consider them a friend, they consider you a friend, it goes over 100%. So basically the chance doubles of an increase in obesity. And it's largely unconscious. You know, they did some incredible, because usually we think we're in charge, we're making the decisions, but context matters so much. And the line I use to try and reinforce this is, you know, what is a nice car to you? What does rich mean to you? You can't answer that question without context. A nice car to you is not a nice car to Jeff Bezos. It's not a nice car to Elon Musk. You have to have context. Yeah. You know, what does rich mean? Rich to you is not rich to Jeff Bezos. Context matters. Our standards, our judgments come from the community around us. So it is so critical. But specifically to what your audience is dealing with, those obesity metrics were huge. Those smoking metrics were huge. We are subtly influenced constantly by the people around us in so many of our health behaviors. People think that smoking has largely been banned in many public places. And we think, oh, that's good because I won't get secondhand smoke, I won't breathe it. Certainly that's good. But that's not the biggest reason why banning smoking is helpful. Banning smoking is helpful because if my friends smoke, I am more likely to start smoking. The secondhand smoke isn't nearly as lethal as the fact if my friends start smoking, I could pick up the habit. That's much more deadly to me. And then if I pick up the habit, my family and friends can pick up the habit. What's really critical is that influence that we have over, and again, it's largely unconscious. So I always recommend, you know, try to spend more time of the friends you have. Try to spend more time with the people you want to be like. And for your group, joining a community of other people who are trying to improve their lives, trying to stay in shape, is one of the most powerful and easy. It's easy. You can be lazy. All you got to do is show up. Just hang out, and you're gonna have a little bit of social pressure that's gonna be good for you.
Totally. That's so interesting about the smoking. So it's not even that I'm breathing in the secondhand smoke that's harming me. It's that I'm watching other people smoke and therefore being subtly influenced by it, even if I don't think so. Yeah. you look cool.
That's the real danger.
That's so interesting. Okay. So, but then I think some people are like, okay, well, what am I going to do? My kids will only eat Cocoa Pebbles and grilled cheese. And my partner really loves to unwind with some beer and nachos. Yeah. So what am I supposed to do about that?
I mean, to the degree you can, when you spend time with friends, when you get together as a group, when you're deciding which kids you'd like your kids to play with and which ones maybe not so much. If your spouse wants to hang out, you know, as couple night with their friend, which couples are you picking? We have influence over all of these things. You know, which events do we go to? Who do we go them with? You know, these are all things we can think about because, again, it's not that like, oh, you know, we enjoy the company, but we don't enjoy the company of others. We don't merely enjoy the company of others. We become the people that we spend time with in many ways. And the most insidious part is we often don't realize it. They did one study that was phenomenal. They asked college students, how much do you drink? How much do you think your fellow students drink? And what they found was, you know, there was an average. And they wanted to figure out how can we get students to drink less. Well, the problem was if they gave the information, what they found was if they gave the information about what the average student was drinking and the student they were talking to drank less, this caused them to increase their drinking. Now the average is higher and, again, largely unconscious. You know, those scared straight programs where they expose kids at risk to, like, you know, criminals in prison, they don't decrease criminal behavior. They increase criminal behavior.
Really?
13%. Because you are taking a group of kids who has potential problems with the law and putting them together in a group.
Right, yeah. So
we are heavily influenced by those around us. So joining something like your Facebook group where people all have healthy values and are trying to do the right thing is enormous. The other factor that's really critical in communities is, like I said, friendship's great. You know, if you got five friends, that's great. You know what's even greater? The research shows if those five friends know each other, you are going to feel much more supported and much happier. Because five friends who don't know each other, that's great. You have like a hub and spoke type relationship. But when your five friends all know each other, now you have a community. People can coordinate. Your friends can say, hey, she's feeling down. We should do something for her this weekend. They can do more. So communities are so much more powerful than merely having more friends.
Oh, I like that. And so the hub and spoke, it's like a web of everyone kind of coordinating. I like that so much. Okay. One of the teasers in your book says social media can actually improve relationships. Yeah. What? How? How does that happen?
Social media, I mean, definitely. There's plenty to be critical of. We've all heard a lot of that. But, you know, social media is also a tool for communication. You know, what's great isn't just replacing face-to-face time with social media. Some of us had to do that during the pandemic. We didn't have a choice. But now that we're starting to come out of the pandemic, if you use social media, what the research shows is if you use social media as a replacement for face-to-face contact, you're going to get more depressed. If you use social media as a leverage point to, hey, great talking to you on Instagram, let's get coffee tomorrow. If you use social media as a springboard to connect in real life, it can be a net positive. Hey, somebody's post came up. I totally forgot about them for months. I should catch up with them. Don't just post a comment. Don't just hit the like button. Message them and say, let's talk on the phone. Let's hang out. Mm. If you use it as a reminder of your relationships and leverage that to meet face-to-face or on the phone, you will become happier. It can be a positive thing. But it shouldn't be the end point. It should be the starting point.
That's so interesting. And does it counteract the effects of social media that we've all heard about in the like negative comparison and all of those kind of bad feelings that people can get when they're scrolling?
I mean, those are always there. You don't want to spend too much time on there, but there are also benefits to social media as well. Like, this is where the debate is ongoing because you can see positive things. Your friend had a kid. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You can see positives. You can see negatives. You know, the issue is the undeniable negative is when the time, when our buddy budget, the friendship amount of time we have gets cannibalized by social media. When you start spending your social time on Instagram instead of face-to-face, that's the biggest threat because it's zero sum. There's only 24 hours in a day. You're going to sleep. You're going to work. You gotta shower and eat. You only have so much time for friends. If that is totally eaten up by social media, that's a total negative.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to take you back to, so in your Barking Up the Wrong Tree, you said for people who want improved health, association with other healthy people is usually the strongest and most direct path of change. And like you said, it's easy. You just got to show up. So, and then, so I mentioned that you've got, you know, let's say you've got a spouse who really likes to eat the nachos and whatever. And then in your new book, you've got a teaser that says you are going to tell us an ethical and effective way to get your partner to change. Yeah. So can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. This is the research on this. It's called the Michelangelo effect. And basically, when people try to change their partners, A, it usually doesn't work. And B, it reduces relationship satisfaction. It's not a good
thing. That makes sense to me. Yeah.
Here's the thing. It's not just a universal negative. The negative is the way we usually go about it. There's always a bit of selfishness in there. We are not trying to turn them into the Dalai Lama or some paragon of perfection. We're usually trying to turn them into something we want. The trick is to successful... to change that actually works and change that makes the relationship better is to talk to your partner, asking questions and finding out more about what is their ideal self. Who do they want to be? Mm-hmm. What are their goals? Where do they feel they're lacking? And then help them become that thing. Now you've removed the selfish aspect from it. Now you're helping them be the person they want to be. And let's face it, a lot of those things are going to overlap with things you'd want. They probably don't want to be less healthy. They probably don't want to be less happy. They probably don't want to make less money. So by talking to your partner, which is good in general, asking them those questions, you know, and as I talk about it, I talk also about the research from John Gottman, who's the leading researcher on love and happiness. You know, really getting to know your partner, it sounds a little cliche, but ask the tough questions. What does love mean to you? What does marriage mean to you? What does happiness mean to you? Those are tough questions. But the issue is we're going to learn some things. We're going to learn some things because what we often do is what's called egocentric anchoring. We think that what our vision of happiness or marriage or love is the same as theirs. And it's going to be a little bit different. And when we talk to them, we get that better idea of how they define those things. It's a really powerful thing that can help a relationship. And ask them, what is your ideal self? Who would you like to be? What changes would you like to make? And then it's just a matter of, you don't want to be critical. You don't want to be wagging your finger when they aren't.
Right.
You want to be supportive when they do those things. You know, when they start, if they do start exercising, if they do start eating better, you want to reward that. You want to be supportive. And that's a really powerful, effective way to help your partner change.
That's a great shift in perspective. One thing I wanted to ask, when you were saying they might have a different idea of love, do you talk about the love languages?
I go a little bit more fundamental in terms of relationships. So, I mean, if they say something along those lines, sure, great.
Yeah.
But, you know, but what's really critical is, you know, what I found is the negatives that people usually engage in that hurt a marriage, hurt a relationship, are usually the same. John Gottman found the biggest four are criticism, defensiveness, stonewalling, and contempt. And if we can get away from those, that's really good. But, you know, we often try and fix the negatives. Well, fixing the negatives doesn't necessarily make something great. It just might make it neutral. I have a not negative relationship with every stranger on this planet. That's not love. Right. What we need to do is up the positive, because that's where it's really great. Because what Gottman found is that love, when it works, it's a 5-to-1 ratio, 5 positive things for every 1 negative. That's why you know some couples that bicker or fight, but they can still be happy because even though they have those negatives, they have even more positives to outweigh it. And how we can achieve that is do more exciting stuff together. There's something in psychology called emotional contagion. And basically, whatever environment we're in, again, context, whatever environment we're in, we associate those feelings and emotions with who we're with. So instead of date night being more Netflix and pizza, go out and exercise together. Go horseback riding. You want a fairy tale marriage? Go slay a dragon together. You know, it's just like go do fun, exciting stuff, because you will come to associate those positive, energetic feelings with your partner.
Right, of course. Okay, I love it. You said that we should ask our partners hard questions. And I was wondering if I could ask you a hard question.
Okay.
You said that you started this project because you were not so great at relationships. So now that you're done, would you share a little thing that you've tweaked about how you approach relationships?
Yeah. Well, in my friendships, you know, what I found is I looked at all the Dale Carnegie stuff, which actually most of it, not all, most of it is validated by the research. But that's really good for the beginning of relationships.
Like what, like use people's names, like that kind of stuff?
Use people's names, express similarity. The one thing Carnegie was wrong about was he said, try and see things from the other person's perspective. And psychology shows we're terrible at that. we usually get it wrong and it makes things worse. We're making assumptions. But Carnegie's stuff doesn't tell you how to make deep friendships, doesn't tell you how to deepen your relationships. So when I looked at the research there, the two critical things for deepening your relationships were time and vulnerability. Time is the thing friends most often argue about. You know, time is a very costly signal. If I spend an hour a day with you, I can only do that for 24 people. That's it, the end. Thank you for calling. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
So it's a powerful signal to make time for people. And in Notre Dame research, they looked at 8 million phone calls over the period of years. And they found that people who touch base every 2 weeks were more likely to stay friends. So time is critical. So now I try and make time, more time. And the other critical thing, which I was really bad at, was vulnerability, was opening up. Basically, you've got to open up, talk about your fears, talk about your weaknesses. We need to do those things. Not only is it important for the relationship, but talk about health. Not opening up, not being vulnerable. University of Pennsylvania study showed it prolongs minor illnesses, increases the chance of a first heart attack, and increases the chance that that heart attack will be lethal. You know, we need to have people we can talk to about our problems. And on the flip side, what's really powerful is when you tell people things that are scary, when you tell things that could be used against you, that is a powerful display of trust. And that shows people you feel safe with them, you trust them, and they are very likely to reciprocate. So these are things I've been engaging in to try and improve some of my relationships.
Good for you. I mean, that takes some courage to
absolutely
do those things.
Oh, yeah. You have no idea.
Yeah, no, for sure. It does. Props. One final question for you, Eric. So the last few years have been hard. I saw clients who were just killing it, and then pandemic and all sorts of stuff happened and they kind of disappeared. And, you know, you quote in your book, in Barking Up the Wrong Tree, you quote a Harvard researcher who said, the people who survive stress the best are the ones who actually increase their social investments in the middle of stress, which is the exact opposite of what most people do.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if you have any tips for, you know, it seems like going into another stressful period, or maybe this is the new normal or whatever, but any tips for increasing our social interaction when really it's the last thing we want to do?
I mean, you know, when first off, that's where vulnerability is critical, you know, is again, being able to open up and saying you're scared. Frankly, you know, it's been a very tough time, but one silver lining is we have all been dealing with tough times now. You don't have to feel scared about saying it's been a struggle, because it's been a struggle for all of us. We've all dealt with difficulties. So rather than feeling like, oh, I'm going to be a burden, we've all dealt with difficulties during the pandemic. It's nothing to be ashamed of. talk about it. Once you do, that is going to be rewarding in itself. Being able to talk about it, you're going to feel better. Having a listening ear, having somebody tell you the specific things they've been dealing with, that's going to be a positive feeling that is going to want to make you reconnect with people, going to make you reach out. The other thing I talk about in terms of making time for friends is the issue of if it's something we have to deliberately schedule, like appointments, it's going to fall by the wayside. That feels like work. What we want to do is try and make it organic. You know, it's like if you can have a habit, a ritual together, you know, where like, you know, you both exercise together. Great.
Yeah.
Every Saturday we have lunch. We don't need to set up. We do that every Saturday. You know,
right.
We play chess together. Have a thing, a ritual that, like I said, you don't need to send reminders because it is as predictable as sleep and eating. Find those organic things that are natural. If you're super busy, you know, go shopping together, you know, just for food. You know, take the chores, the errands that you both have to do, do them together. That way it's not, you're not adding a new thing to the calendar. You're just adding a friend to the calendar. But when we make things organic like that, then all of a sudden it can become really effortless because it's already in the schedule and we don't have to think about it.
I love that. Yeah, that's great. Cool. Well, okay, Eric, so Plays Ball with Others comes out tomorrow. I'm sure it's going to be another huge hit. Just so you guys know, the last one, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, it's translated to 19 languages, did you say?
Yeah.
And it was the subject of a Jeopardy question, which is very cool. Very cool. So it's going to be another amazing book. I'm super excited about it. Where can people find out about it and get a pre-order of their copy so that it comes on their Kindle tomorrow?
Oh, the URL of my blog is a little tricky for some people. So if they go to ericbarker.org, ericbarker.org, that's my website. If people pre-order the book, there's a whole chapter. I had to cut because of length purposes because my publisher had a word count limit. So you get 25% more book if you pre-order. So
nice.
It's pretty cool. But no, if people go to ericbarker.org, and both books, Bark Up the Wrong Tree and Plays Well with Others, are both available on Amazon and most other big booksellers.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Congratulations about the book. And I hope you have a great pub week.
Thank you. This was fantastic.
All right. Talk soon.